Chapter 55. Strait had heard the sirens too, and he couldn't believe how quickly everything had gone to hell. Story of his life. He put his gun against Claire's head and pulled out her gag. He had already untied her so he wouldn't have to carry her.
"Afraid you're my ticket out of here, lady. And even that might not be enough. But just so you don't get your hopes up, if it looks like they're going to take me, I'm going to shoot you."
"Why?" wailed Claire helplessly.
"'Cause I'm pissed off, that's why. 'Cause I worked my ass off for nothing, that's why. Now come on."
He jerked her along as they made their way toward the equestrian center. There were trucks there that maybe, just maybe, he could use to get out of here. They were approaching the center from the east, and when he saw the peak of the big hay barn, Strait actually smiled. The farm was vast, and its topography complex, and the cops would come in the front, no doubt, while Strait left from the rear. By the time they realized what was going on, he would have ditched the truck, gotten to the little safe house he had set up just for this contingency, and then quietly disappeared, not with all his money, but with some of it. They cleared a rise in the land and started down toward the horse stalls. The man came at them from out of the darkness. At first, Strait thought it was Macy, but then the clouds moved past and the moonlight revealed Billy Canfield standing there, shotgun in hand. Strait instantly held Claire in front of him, the gun to her temple.
"Get out the way, old man. I ain't got no time for you."
"Why, because the cops are coming? You damn right they are, 'cause I called them."
Strait shook his head, a vicious look on his features.
"And why'd you do that?"
"I don't know what the hell you've been doing on my farm, but I do know you've been sleeping with my wife. You must think I'm stupid or something."
"Well, somebody had to be screwing her, Billy, 'cause you sure as hell weren't."
"That's my business," roared Canfield, "not yours."
"Oh, it's my business, all right. Let me tell you, it was some damn fine business. You didn't know what you were missing, old man."
Canfield raised his shotgun.
"Yeah, go on and fire, Billy. And with that scatter gun, you'll kill this nice lady, too."
The men silently stared at each other until Strait completely realized his advantage. Still using Claire as a shield, he pointed his pistol at Billy and prepared to fire.
"Billy!"
Strait looked over in time to see Gwen and Baron charging straight at him. He yelled, pushed Claire away, and got off two quick shots. And then a bullet hit him in the head, instantly crumpling him. Webb had rushed out of the woods, quickly taken in what was happening, and fired, killing Strait. Baron reared up, and his front hooves came down on Strait's body. Webb quickly ran to Claire's side. He didn't have to check Strait. He knew the man was dead.
"Are you okay?" he asked Claire.
She nodded, then sat up and started crying. Webb hugged her and then looked over and saw that Billy Canfield had shuffled over to a dark mass and then dropped to his knees. Webb rose and went over to him and looked at where Gwen lay on the ground, her chest covered by a pool of blood, where at least one of Strait's shots had hit its mark. She looked up at them both, her breath coming in painful gasps. Webb dropped to his knees, ripped open her shirt, and saw the wound. He slowly covered her chest back up and looked at her. His expression obviously told her the truth. She gripped his hand.
"I'm so scared, Webb."
Webb knelt down closer as Billy just squatted there, staring at his dying wife. "You're not alone, Gwen." That was all he could think to say. He wanted to hate this woman for what she had done to him, to Teddy Reiner, and all the rest, but he couldn't. And it wasn't just because she had saved his life, and Claire's and Kevin's. It was because Webb didn't know what he would have done had he been in the woman's shoes, with all that rage and hatred building up over the years. Maybe he would have done the same. He just hoped not.
I'm not scared of dying, Webb. I'm scared I won't see David.
Blood dribbled from her mouth, and her words were a little garbled, but Webb understood her. Heaven and hell, that was it? With maybe purgatory not even an option. Her eyes were starting to lose focus, and Webb could feel her grip loosening.
David,
she said weakly.
David.
She looked to the sky.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Her voice trailed off, and she started sobbing. Webb assumed the woman would have crawled to her little chapel if she'd had the strength. He looked around for something, anything, and then it appeared in the form of Paul Romano walking stiffly over to them. He had driven off in the truck that had been hooked to the trailer by the pool, flat tires and all, thanks to Webb. Webb rushed over to him, looked at his bloody leg. You okay?
Just a scratch. Thanks for asking.
Paulie, can you take Gwen's last confession?
What?
Webb pointed to where Gwen lay in the grass. Gwen's dying. I want you to hear her last confession. Romano took a step back.
Are you nuts? Do I look like a priest?
She's dying, Paulie. She won't know. She believes she's going to hell and she won't see her son.
This is the same woman who masterminded wiping out Charlie Team, and you want me to forgive her too for all the stuff she's done?
Yes, it's important.
No way am I doing that.
Come on, Romano, it won't kill you. Romano looked to the sky for an instant.
How do you know?
Paulie, please. I know I have no right to ask you, but please, there's not much time. It's the right thing to do. He added in desperation, God will understand. The men stared at each other for a long moment, and then Romano shook his head, limped over, and knelt down beside Gwen. He took her hand in his, made the sign of the cross over her, and asked her if she wanted to make her last confession. In weakening tones, she said she did. Finished, Romano rose and stepped away. Webb again knelt down beside Gwen. Her eyes were starting to glaze over, but for a brief moment, she was able to focus on him and even gave him a weak smile as though to thank him, as with each breath, she pumped more blood out of her body. The resemblance to the wound that had claimed her son was striking. She clutched Webb's hand with renewed strength and mouthed the words.
I'm so sorry, Webb. Can you forgive me?
Webb looked at the beautiful eyes that were growing dimmer by the second. In those eyes and the woman's features, he saw a different image, that of a young boy who had trusted Webb and who had then been failed by him. I forgive you, he said to the dying woman, and he hoped that somewhere, somehow, David Canfield was doing the same for him. With that, Webb stepped back and passed her hand over to Billy, who took it and knelt down beside his wife. Webb watched as the chest rose and fell with greater and greater speed, and then, finally, it just stopped and the hand went limp. As Billy quietly sobbed over the body of his wife, Webb helped Claire stand, put his arm under Romano to assist him, and the three started to walk off together. The shotgun blast made them all jump. When they turned around, Billy was just then walking away from Strait's body, a curl of smoke rising from his shotgun. Chapter 56. For the next few days, the police and the FBI had pored all over East Winds, collecting evidence, wrapping up bodies, and generally trying to figure everything out. Although that, under even the best circumstances, would take some time. On a very somber note, the body of the boy who had been substituted for Kevin in the alley had been found in a grave deep in the woods at East Winds. The boy had been identified as a runaway from Ohio who had somehow had the great misfortune to run into Nemo Strait and Clyde Macy, no doubt with promises of some fast money. As Webb walked over the grounds, he could only shake his head at how quickly the pastoral setting of the farm had turned into a battlefield. Bates had cut short his vacation and was now here overseeing things. Romano was in the hospital getting his leg wound treated, but the bullet had hit neither bone nor major artery, and the doctors predicted a quick and full recovery for someone as fit as Paul Romano. However, Webb was certain that Angie was giving her husband a really hard time about almost getting killed. No doubt if someone was going to do Romano in, she wanted the honors. As Webb was walking up the drive to the mansion, he saw Bates coming out the front door. Billy Canfield stood on the porch and stared at seemingly nothing. The man had nothing left, Webb thought. Bates saw Webb and came over. "Damn, what a mess," Bates said. "Well, it's pretty clear now that it was a mess for a long time before this." "Actually, you're right. We discovered records at Strait's house and chased down his suppliers. The shot that killed Antoine Peebles was traced to a gun we found on Macy. Ed O'Bannon's turned up, too, in a dumpster. Same gun killed him. And the rifle Macy was carrying when you shot him, we matched that to the hits on Judge Ledbetter and Chris Miller."
"A ballistics hat trick. Don't you just love it when the pieces start falling into place?"
"Oh, and we also checked the tape of the shooting in Richmond like you asked us to."
Webb shot him a glance.
"What did you find?"
"You were right, there was something there. A phone ringing."
"It wasn't a ringing sound, it was more like a..."
"A whistle? That's right. It was a cellular phone. You know, you can do just about any ringing sound you want. This one was a bird whistle. Nobody ever thought much about it before. It's not like we needed it as evidence to nail Ernie free."
"Whose phone was it?"
"David Canfield's. A cell phone his mother had given him in case of emergency."
Webb looked stunned, even as Bates nodded sadly.
"It was Gwen calling him. He never answered. Probably the only way she thought she could talk to him at that point. She just picked the worst time to do it. She didn't know when HRT was going in, of course."
"So you think that's why the phones were the theme with the killings?"
"Well, we'll never know for sure, but it looks that way. Maybe she felt since she couldn't talk to her son, she wanted the phones to be the last things those three guys ever saw. She also left a written statement that exonerated Billy. I guess Gwen was thinking she wouldn't survive this, and she turned out to be right. We've confirmed Billy's innocence from other sources. And we were also able to nab a few of Strait's men who weren't at the farm that night. They spilled their guts."
"Good. The man suffered enough."
Bates shook his head.
"Those guys confirmed that Gwen wasn't in on the drug stuff, but I guess she found out later and wanted a cut of it. God, and she looked so normal."
"She was normal," snapped Webb. "But what happened to her son just took over her life."
He sighed deeply.
"You know, I have every reason to hate the woman. And the only thing I feel is sorry for her. Sorry that she couldn't have gone on. And part of me is thinking that if I had saved her son, none of this would have happened. That maybe I do a lot more harm than good."
"You can't carry that burden, Webb. That's not fair to you."
"Well, life wasn't very fair to Gwen Canfield now, was it?"
The two men walked along.
Well, if you want some good news, you're reinstated with the Bureau. And if you so request, Buck Winters will give you a personal apology. And I'm counting on you so requesting.
Webb shook his head. I need some time to think about it, Purse.
Buck's apology?
Coming back to the Bureau. Bates gaped at him.
You're kidding. Come on, Webb. You got your whole life tied up in it.
I know. That's the problem.
Well, take all the time that you want. After all this, the official word at the Bureau is that anything you want, you got.
Gee, that's really nice of them.
How's Romano?
Bitching and complaining, so he's just fine.
They stopped and looked back at the mansion, where Billy Canfield was just now turning and going into the house. Bates pointed at him.
Now there's the guy I really feel sorry for. He's lost it all.
Webb nodded in agreement.
You remember he said at the party, you keep your enemies out in the open, right where you can see them all the time?
Bates shook his head and looked around.
Well, his enemies were all around him, and the poor guy never knew it.
Yeah.
You need a ride back?
I'm gonna hang here a while longer.
Bates and Webb shook hands.
Thanks, Webb, for everything.
Bates turned and walked off, while Webb ambled along. And then he stopped, turned, and looked in Bates's direction, and then at the mansion. Webb suddenly took off at a dead run to the stone house. He raced through the front door and down the stairs to the lower level, where he made a beeline for Billy's taxidermy room. It was locked. Webb easily broke open the lock, went inside, and quickly found what he was searching for. He carried the small jar in one hand and ran over to the gun cabinet. He found and hit the hidden latch, and the door swung open. He pulled the flashlight off the wall and went inside. The mannequin peered back at him. Webb hung the light on a peg on the wall so that the beam shone on the dummy. He took off the mannequin's hairpiece and carefully peeled off the whiskers. Next, he opened the jar and carefully applied the paint remover to the face. It came off quickly. Webb kept working away until the dark skin became white. With the hair and whiskers gone and the original skin color, Webb stood back. He had seen the face so many times he would have recognized it in his sleep. And yet the few devices Canfield had used to disguise the face had worked to perfection. The man had been true to his word. He had kept his real enemy right where he could always find him. Webb knew he was looking upon Ernest B. Free for the first time since the shootout in Richmond.
You know those Italians I told you about?
Webb whipped around, and there was Billy Canfield.
Those Italians, Billy continued, who'd offer me all that money to move their stolen property? Remember I was telling you about them?
I remember.
Canfield seemed to be in a fog. He wasn't even looking at Webb. He was staring at Ernie, maybe admiring his handiwork, Webb thought.
Well, contrary to what I told you, I accepted one of those offers and did a real good job for them. Then, after what happened to my son and all, they came to me one day about 4 months ago and offered to do me a favor in appreciation for all my years of loyalty to the family.
Break Ernest Free out of prison and deliver him to you.
See, them Italians are strong on family. And after what that man did to my son,
Billy stopped and rubbed at his eyes.
Anyway, Gwen probably showed you the little building, what used to be a Civil War hospital at the farm.
She did.
Well, that's where I did him. I sent Strait and his men off to pick up some horses and put Gwen on a plane to see her family in Kentucky so I could work uninterrupted. I used some of the same surgical instruments the folks back in the Civil War did.
He went over and touched Free's shoulder.
cut his tongue out first, because he was making such a ruckus. I expected that from a little worm like him. Love to make others suffer, but can't take a drop of pain themselves. And then you know what I did?
Tell me.
Billy smiled proudly. I gutted him, just the way you would a deer. Cut his balls off first. See, I figured somebody would done something like that to a little boy. He can't call himself no man. So why would he need any balls? You see my reasoning?
Webb said nothing, but though Billy did not appear to be armed, Webb's hand slipped to the grip of his pistol. Canfield did not seem to notice, or if he did, he didn't seem to care. He cocked his head and surveyed his work from different angles.
Now, I'm not an educated man or anything. Ain't read many books and such. But it seemed sort of poetic justice, I guess you'd say, that old Ernie B. Free would sit locked in a little room where slaves came through hunting for their freedom. But he ain't never gonna get his. Freedom, that is. And I'd know right where the son of a bitch was every minute of every day and show people to frighten them, like he was some little carnival freak.
He looked at Webb with the expression of a man no longer part of the sane world.
Don't that seem right to you?
Again, Webb said nothing. Billy stared at him and nodded.
I'd do it again, you know. In a minute I would.
Tell me, Billy, what did it feel like, killing a man?
Canfield studied him for a very long moment.
It felt like shit.
Did it take any of the hurt away?
Not a damn drop. And now I got nothing left.
He paused, his lips trembling.
I shut her out of my life, you know. My own wife. Drove her to Straight's bed. Ignored her. She knew I knew, and I didn't say nothing about it. And that probably hurt more than if I'd beaten her for it. Right when she needed me most, I wasn't there. Maybe if I had been, she could have got herself through this.
Webb stared at him. Maybe she could have, Billy. But now we'll never know.
They heard footsteps coming down the stairs, and both men walked outside the room. It was Bates. He looked surprised to see Webb.
I forgot I needed to ask you a few more things, Billy.
Bates looked at Webb's pale face.
Are you okay?
He glanced at the stricken Billy and then back at Webb.
What's going on here?
Webb looked at Billy and then said to Bates,
Everything's just fine. Why don't you ask Billy the questions later? I think he needs some time to himself.
Webb looked once more at Canfield, and then he put his arm around Bates and led him up the stairs. They had just reached the main floor when they heard the blast. It was the fancy Churchill shotgun. Webb just knew. Chapter 57. Webb dropped in on Kevin Westbrook 2 days after Billy Canfield killed himself. The boy was back with Jerome and his granny, thanks to his father. Part of Webb hoped Francis Big F. Westbrook made it to his retirement. At least he had left his son out of it. The grandmother, whose name Webb learned was Rosa, was in wonderful spirits and had made them all lunch. As promised, Webb had brought back the photo of Kevin and given it to Rosa, returned the sketchbooks Claire had taken previously to Kevin, and also had a long talk with Jerome.
Never saw the man, said Jerome of Big F. One minute Kevin wasn't here, and now he is.
How's the big cookie coming? Asked Webb.
Jerome smiled and said,
It's in the oven, and I'm about to turn on the heat.
Before Webb left, Kevin gave him a sketch he had done. It showed a little boy and a large man, side by side.
Is that you and your brother?
Webb asked.
Nope, that's me and you, Kevin answered, and then gave Webb a hug. When he went back to his car, Webb got quite a shock. On his windshield was a piece of paper. What was written on the paper made Webb look in all directions, one hand on his pistol grip. Yet the man was long gone. He looked at the paper again. It simply read, "I owe you. Big if." Some other good news was that Randall Cove had been found. Some kids playing in the woods had come across him. He had been admitted into a local hospital as a John Doe, since he was carrying no identification. He had been unconscious for several days, but had finally come to, and the Bureau had been notified. He was also expected to fully recover from his wounds. Webb went to see him after Cove was flown back to Washington. The man was covered in bandages, had lost a lot of weight, and wasn't in the best of moods, but he was alive. That was something to feel good about, Webb told him, and got a growl in return. I've been right where you are, Webb told him, except I was missing half my face. You got off easy. None of it feels easy, not a damn bit. They say bullet wounds give you character. I got enough character to last the rest of my life, then. Webb had glanced around the room. So how long you in for? Hell if I know. I'm just the patient. But if they stick me with one more needle, somebody around here besides me is going to be hurting. I don't like hospitals much either. Well, if I hadn't been wearing my Kevlar, I'd be at the morgue. Got two bruises on my chest I think are with me permanently. First rule of engagement, always place one in the head. I'm glad they didn't read your rules of engagement. So, you broke the oxy ring? I'd say we did it. And you popped straight? Webb nodded. And then Billy Canfield added a layer of buckshot. I don't think it was necessary, but it probably made him feel better. But then again, not that much better. Cove nodded. I guess I can see that. Webb got up to leave. Hey, Webb, I owe you. I mean, I really owe you a lot. No, you don't. Nobody owes me a damn thing. Hey, HRT, you brought the whole house of cards down. What I did was my job. And to tell you the truth, I'm getting a little tired of doing it. The men shook hands. Take it easy, Cove. And when they cut you loose from here, let the Bureau give you a nice, safe desk job where the only nasty things people are shooting at you are memos. Memos? Sounds pretty boring. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Webb parked the Mach at the curb and walked up the sidewalk. Claire Daniels was not dressed in work clothes on this warm evening, but rather a pretty sundress and sandals. The dinner was tasty, the wine a nice companion to the meal, and the lights low and inviting. And Webb had no idea why he was here, as Claire sat across from him on the couch by the empty fireplace and tucked her legs under her. Fully recovered? He asked. Not that I ever will be. Business-wise, I'm great. I thought this thing with O'Bannon would have wrecked my practice, but the phone hasn't stopped ringing. Hey, lots of people are in need of a good shrink. Excuse me, psychiatrist. Actually, I've been taking a fair amount of time off. Different priorities? Something like that. I did see Romano. He's out of the hospital now. Did you go to his house? No, at my office. He came with Angie. I guess she told him about her seeing a psychiatrist. I'm helping them work through some issues together. They said they didn't mind you knowing. Webb took a sip of wine. Well, everybody sure as hell has issues, don't they? I wouldn't be surprised if Romano left HRT. We'll see. She eyed him. So, are you leaving HRT?
We'll see.
She put down the wine glass she'd been holding. I wanted to thank you for saving my life, Webb. That's one of the reasons I invited you for dinner tonight. He tried to keep it light. Hey, that's what I do, rescue hostages. But then his jovial look faded.
You're welcome, Claire. I'm just glad I was there.
He looked at her curiously.
One of the reasons. So what are the others?
Cueing on my body language? Reading between the lines? She refused to catch his gaze, and Webb could sense the nervousness underneath the joking manner.
What is it, Claire?
I'm filing my report with the FBI soon. The report detailing what I believe happened to you in the alley when you froze. I wanted to discuss it with you first.
Webb sat forward. Okay, let me have it.
I think O'Bannon gave you a post-hypnotic suggestion, a command, an instruction of sorts to stop you from doing your job.
But you said that you can't make someone do something they don't want to do or wouldn't do normally while under hypnosis.
That's right, but there are always exceptions to such rules. If the person being hypnotized has a very strong relationship with the person doing the hypnotizing, or that person is a powerful authority figure, the person may do something outside his normal range of action, even hurting someone else. The rationale may be that he feels this authority figure would not make anyone do something really wrong. It really comes down to issues of trust. And according to his notes, O'Bannon had established a trusting relationship with you.
How do you get from trust to me freezing? Did he brainwash me? Like the Manchurian candidate?
Brainwashing is something very different from hypnotizing. It takes time and is more of an indoctrination in which, through sleep deprivation, physical torture, and mental manipulation, you change the personality of someone, make him wholly different. You break his will, his spirit, and then you recast it as you wish. What O'Bannon did was build into your unconscious an order. When you heard the phrase, "damn to hell," the reaction would start. The phrase was coupled with a safety valve of some sort, in case you heard the phrase or something similar to it elsewhere. In your case, I think that safety valve was hearing communications over your wireless receiver when you were in the alley. Remember, that's when you said you actually froze. In O'Bannon's notes was a record of the taser gun story you also told me. So the physical reaction he programmed in was one he knew would paralyze you. Damn to hell, plus communications over the radio, would cause you to freeze, like you had been hit with a taser dart.
Webb shook his head. And O'Bannon could do all that to my mind?
Claire said, I believe you to be a somnambule, Webb. A person very susceptible to hypnotic suggestion. But you were almost able to override that suggestion. I'm certain you weren't supposed to be able to rise and walk in that courtyard. That was your pure will coming through, if that makes you feel any better. It was probably your most remarkable feat of the night, machine guns notwithstanding.
And they used the phrase "damn to hell" to further incriminate the Free Society because it was the name of their newsletter.
Yes. When I saw that on their website, lots of things started making sense.
That's a lot to take in, Claire.
She sat forward, her hands in her lap. Suddenly, Webb felt like he was back in her office, enduring another session. Webb, I have something else to tell you, something even more disconcerting. I should have told you before, but I wasn't sure you were ready to deal with it, and with everything that happened, well, I was just afraid to, I guess. Compared to you, I'm not very brave. Compared to you, nobody's brave, actually. He ignored the compliment and simply stared at her.
Tell me what?
She looked directly at him. When I hypnotized you, I learned a lot more than that your father was arrested at your 6th-year birthday party. She added quickly, but I couldn't tell you about it then. It would have been too traumatic.
Tell me what?
I don't remember a damn thing happening other than the party, and even that was a little fuzzy.
Webb, please listen very carefully to me.
He rose in his distress.
I thought you said I was in complete control, that it was a heightened state of awareness.
Damn it, that's what you said, Claire. Did you lie to me?
It's usually that way, Webb, but I had to do it differently, for a very good reason.
The only reason I let you play around in my mind, lady, was because you said I'd be there running the show.
Webb sat down and clenched his hands together so they'd stop shaking.
What the hell had he told her while he was under, other than the birthday fiasco?
There are times, Webb, when I have to make the decision not to allow the patient under hypnosis to remember what occurred. I don't take that step lightly, and I certainly didn't do it lightly with you.
He had to admire her. In voice and manner, she was in control. He didn't know whether to lean across and kiss her or slap her face.
What exactly, Claire, did you do to me?
I gave you a post-hypnotic suggestion.
She looked down.
The same technique O'Bannon used on you to make you freeze in the alley so you wouldn't remember some things from our hypnosis session.
Great, Claire. I'm easy. I'm a frigging somnambule, so it's easy to screw with my mind, right?
Webb, I did what I thought was best.
Claire, just tell me, snapped Webb impatiently.
It has to do with your mother and your stepfather. How he died, actually.
His face flushed for an instant. He was suddenly fearful. He suddenly hated her guts.
I already told you how he died. He fell. It's in your precious little file. Go read it again.
You're right. He did fall, but he wasn't alone. You told me about a pile of clothes near the attic entrance?
He stared at her.
They're gone. They've been gone a long time.
They were a great hiding place for a terrified and abused young man to hide.
What, meaning me?
A great hiding place at the behest of your mother. She knew that Stockton went up there to get his drugs.
So what? I knew that too. I told you that when I wasn't hypnotized.
You also told me about some rolls of old carpet.
She added very quietly,
that they were as hard as iron.
Webb stood and backed away from her like a frightened child.
Okay, Claire, this is officially nuts.
She got you to do it, Webb. That was her way of taking care of the abusive father.
Webb sat down on the floor and put his head in his hands.
I'm not understanding any of this, Claire. None of it.
Claire took a deep breath.
You didn't kill him, Webb. You struck him with the carpet and he fell. But your mother...
Stop it! He shouted. Just stop it! This is the biggest bunch of bullshit I've ever heard.
Webb, I'm telling you the truth. Otherwise, how would I know these things?
I don't know, he shouted. I don't know anything.
Claire knelt down in front of him, reached out and took his hand.
After all you've done for me, I feel terrible about all of it. But please believe me that I only did it to help you. This was so hard for me, too. Can you understand that? Can you believe that? Can you trust me?
He stood so abruptly she almost fell backward in surprise. Webb headed for the door. She called after him.
Webb, please.
He walked outside and she followed him,
the tears falling freely from her now. Webb climbed in the car and fired up the Mach. Claire walked unsteadily down the sidewalk toward him.
Webb, we can't leave it like this.
He rolled down the window and looked at her, even as Claire's eyes searched his.
I'm going away for a while, Claire. She looked bewildered.
Going away? Where?
I'm going to see my father. Why don't you analyze that one while I'm gone?
He gunned the Mach and drove off under a sky dominated by a gathering storm, yet with a few shafts of light here and there, but dark, mostly dark.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Last Man Standing, written by David Baldacci and read by Jason Culp. This book is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.